You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 11th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein is in tax preparation hell once again. This is, I guess, the last week before the final deadline, right? The deadline for delayed, you know, postponement of taxes. Yeah.
The late tax deadline.
Yeah, the late tax deadline. So he's busy. So, guys, you hear the NASA announcement today? They had a big press release, a big media event. Jay and I were on, we're live streaming on TikTok and when that happened. You know, it was boring. It was, you know, it's, God bless them, NASA, right? They try really hard.
And
yeah, right. I mean, it was, I mean, the actual information was interesting, although it was very preliminary. There wasn't a lot of it. And it was basically like a half an hour buildup. Mm. Like you felt you were in a corporate meeting kind of thing, you know? They really need to upgrade their whole public outreach science communication thing. You know,
at least for their press releases, because I feel like they do such a great job with a lot of stuff. But then these weird announcements.
Yeah, they're always anticlimactic, you know, and then they had something so cool to talk about this time. And they just managed to bury it so deep in the middle of this just like corporate style presentation thing where like, what are they even talking about? It's like, you know what I mean? It was.
Yeah, it sucks.
But the good news is this is all about the OSIRIS-REx probe. You know, bringing back samples from asteroid Bennu, which we talked about last week, I believe. Pretty exciting preliminary information. They have a lot more material than they thought they were going to have. So I guess they have like an outer chamber and an inner chamber. The inner chamber is where the samples are supposed to be. And then there's a protective outer casing. Yeah. But there was a lot of material in the outer casing, and they weren't really expecting that. So they haven't even cracked open the inner casing yet because they're still painstakingly collecting, you know, all of the bits.
My God,
in the outside.
Wow.
And they, yeah, it's really good. So a lot of samples. That's good. It's, you know, there's 4.7% carbon by weight. So a lot of carbon rich material. And they also found that there are hydrated clay. So there's water in there too. So already there's some, interesting preliminary
results.
Water
and carbon.
Not surprising, but, you know, but interesting. They said in 6 months they'll be ready to basically have a catalog where they could start accepting applications to give scientists pieces of the asteroid to study. You know.
Oh wow. Okay.
But that's it. What I just told you was like all the interesting information, but that took an hour. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Wow. I just love the idea of us sending rockets out there and bringing stuff back. It's always just like amazing. Like, oh my God, that's great. Cause you know, it takes so long to get there, but also to get back and then collect it, which I'm sure is not easy.
I
love it.
The mission kicked ass. It was a tour de force. They nailed it. You know, they picked a good asteroid. They said they picked a good piece of the asteroid. They got more sample, greater. They exceeded mission parameters. They returned it all back to Earth successfully. And now, it's science time.
It's amazing that, you know, they're running these unbelievably difficult missions, like, flawlessly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, when you really think about what they did, it's like, what? It's like, we're in the future.
Oh, it is amazing. Like, I think when they sent the New Horizons probe to Pluto, and someone, I think they did that, you know, it was basically the equivalent of sinking a 20-mile putt. You know what I mean? Like, that's the level of accuracy that we're talking about. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
Those laws of physics, man, they never steer you wrong.
Yeah, right.
You know, I think people need to be reminded that, you know, they launched this rocket in 2016, you know, so this thing has probably been in the works for a decade.
Yeah.
You know, they had engineered it perfectly. It, you know, the launch, you know, reaching an asteroid that's, you know, in motion, getting a sample, flying it all the way back to Earth, you know. There's a lot to be romantic about in there, you know, a lot of things to be really in awe of. And I just don't think that I don't think they know how to sell it.
Which is odd, you know, given what they do. But anyway, but the missions was awesome, very successful. And we'll be waiting for a lot more science to come on examining the asteroid. It did make, yeah, some of the scientists made the best points. Like, we're going to be studying this material for the next 50 years with instruments we haven't even created yet, questions we haven't even asked yet.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Those are the kind of statements that have really put it into perspective for you.
And the other important thing is that there have been other sample returns similar to this in the past, but this one has a lot of material, which means more science.
All right. Speaking of science, Bob, you're going to get us started with a quickie.
Yes. Thank you, Steve. Interesting study was recently published in Scientific Reports called Interstellar Photovoltaics. Would modern solar panels work near the closest star to the sun, Proxima Centauri? Interesting question. Would we call them Proxima panels, perhaps? not solar panels, right? Solar panels have obviously been optimized to work specifically with our sun, with its copious amounts of ultraviolet light, visible light, and sometimes even infrared. Proxima Centauri is a red dwarf star with a mass 12.5% of the sun's mass, small, and much of the light it emits is in infrared. This study focused on organic photovoltaics, which makes sense since they're essentially much lighter and flexible. And it's what you would need if you're going to create large solar sails, which many designs that deal with interstellar probes choose them because of that. Organic photovoltaics also have an advantage over the more common silicon-based cells since they can be more easily tuned to different wavelengths. Now, this paper concluded that solar panels wouldn't work well at Proxima Centauri because of the wide band gap our panels use to get the electric current flowing. A narrow band gap would work much, much better. And they ran some simulations, and the efficiency for Proxima Centauri went from like 0.9% efficient to 12%, you know, huge, huge leap. The other major disadvantage is currently more problematic, however. Red dwarf stars put out, as you might imagine, much less light than our sun. So even if you have great efficiency, it really wouldn't help that much unless the solar sail was much larger, which of course then means that it would be a huge increase in cost and weight. So very interesting article. I recommend you checking out online. This has been your Quickie with Bob. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, basically solar panels work well when you're relatively close to a star that puts out light in a reasonable spectrum. I know we talked about the fact that like in our system at Mars, you're at 50% of the energy, right, as you are at Earth. And at Jupiter, you're at 5%. So solar panels not work very well if we had a station like in orbit around Jupiter. Again, even at Mars are half as effective as they are on Earth.
Yeah, and not just distance, so obviously, right? It's more of like the type of light that's being emitted is the fundamental problem with Proxima Centauri.
With Proxima,
which you could deal with using these different ideas. Interesting. I hope we have the chance to even seriously implement this idea.
The thing is, though, we're not going to need to worry about this for such a long time that I think we'll technologically work it out.
Well, I mean, I don't know. We could right now, we have the technology right now to send a probe, like a nanograms, super tiny probe using directed energy to Proxima Centauri within 20, 30 years. What's it called? Starshot? I mean, this is something that we can do pretty much right now. It wouldn't be much of an effort to get it there within a generation, which is incredible. Of course, it would do a flyby and it would just, it would send back some data. But still, we could do it now. And I'd love to have some billionaires like, yes, I'm going to get a little tiny probe to Proxima Centauri within 20 years. That'd be amazing. Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't have a solar panel on.
No, you'd have solar sails. Yeah, that's true. But I still would love to see that.
Okay, have you guys heard about the footprints at the White Sands National Park?
It changes the how we date the first people that lived on the continent, right?
Yeah. So this has been a story that we've been following on the SGU for many years. The archaeological evidence for the peopling of the Americas, right? So what is the evidence
peopling of America?
What is the evidence of the first Homo sapiens, the first human beings to enter North and South America? Now, of course, people evolved out of Africa and then into Europe and Asia, right? So they would have had to have crossed over to North and South America somehow.
Land bridge.
Well, the oldest theory is that basically when the timing was correct in terms of the glacial maximums and minima, that a land bridge opens up across from Siberia to Alaska, basically, right? The Bering Strait, and people can migrate over. That doesn't necessarily mean they came over all at once. They might have migrated over hundreds, even thousands of years, but they were able to pass over that land bridge. Maybe they were following herds of caribou or whatever it was around at that time, and that's what happened. So for a while, starting like in the 1940s, the dominant hypothesis was the Clovis first hypothesis, but the Clovis culture is the first evidence of people in the Americas dating back to 12,000 to 13,000 years ago. And everyone was kind of happy with that because, first of all, there's evidence for the Clovis culture all over the Americas. And they're basically known primarily from the stone points they left behind. They have the famous fluted points, at the base of the point. It's sort of chipped away so it's narrower, front to back. And that was probably made it easier to haft it, to either a spear or an arrow or whatever. So that's a very distinctive technological innovation that typifies Clovis points. And we call it Clovis culture because that's what the evidence that we have of this, this stone point culture everywhere. I think there's 10,000 different Clovis points across North America have been cataloged up to this point. But
all similar.
They have that characteristic fluted, the fluted points. However, guess how many skeletons, human skeletons, we have associated with Clovis Point?
Zero?
One.
Yeah, I'm guessing it's low. One?
One. One.
Off by an infinite
There's
amount.
A burial site of a 1 to 1.5-year-old boy found at Anzac Site in Wilsale, Montana. But this did allow for DNA analysis. Now we've had evidence of a person, right, from about 12,000 years ago.
Bone marrow?
The question was, I'm assuming, the question was, did the Clovis people die out and then be replaced by a later migration of the ancestors of American Indians, or did they become the American Indians? And the DNA evidence found that they probably became the American Indians. They have tremendous overlap in DNA. So they probably, there may have been later migrations that they interbred with, but whatever. They definitely, their genes are in modern American Indians.
Why so few bodies, though?
Yeah, it's a good question. Just conditions, I guess, were not amenable to it. Maybe they're who knows? Maybe they cremated their dead. I mean, we don't know. But there was this one burial site, of a boy. But it's been very controversial whether or not there was any pre-Clovis culture in the Americas.
Right.
And every time something comes up, like maybe this is evidence of pre-Clovis culture, it doesn't matter. A lot of skepticism among the experts, partly because around 14,000 years ago, that's when the most recent glacial maximum was going away, right? And so that's the last 14,000 years ago is about the last time that the land bridge opened up. So it all fit together. They were able to cross starting around 14,000 years ago. They're here from 12 to 13,000 years ago, and there you go.
But people had boats.
Yeah, so if you're going to push it back farther than that, you have to hypothesize. Like if you're going to say, there's been controversial evidence, but mounting evidence of human presence going back to 16,000 years ago, and that of course is during the glacial maximum. When they said, well, how did they get here? Then they couldn't have crossed over the land bridge. So the alternate hypothesis is that they migrated along the coastline, right? But basically up Siberia, down Alaska. But they probably would have had to have used boats to sort of hop along the coastline with boats.
And, so they were still coming from that region, though.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't cross the Atlantic or something. They were just basically, rather than walking across land, they were boating along the shore, right?
Right.
So that's the alternate hypothesis. And evidence has been accumulating for this 16,500-year-old pre-Clovis culture. The latest evidence comes from Cooper's Ferry site in Idaho, where it looks like a human habitation site. Again, no people, that would be nice, but there is hearths and animal bones that were cooked, and those have been carbon dated to 16,500 years ago. But again, it's not this home run evidence that's enough to end the controversy, but it has been mounting. Okay. Now let's go to the new evidence, right? Mm. White Sands National Park in New Mexico. So thousands of years ago, this was wetter, cooler, and probably lush vegetation, lots of animals, not the desert that it is now. And they have found a lot of, like, in the White Sands, there's a lot of fossilized, sand. There's a lot of fossilized footprints of animals, right?
And sand.
Yeah, basically in the ancient sand. It basically hardened, and there you have a fossilized footprint that it gets covered with later layers, you know, to
That's
preserve
cool.
it. Yeah, so it's classic. Like a whole field of prints. And we've started to find human footprints there. There's this one cool track. They actually traced a mother carrying a toddler for about a mile.
That's cool.
Crazy wow. kid.
And they so, can tell, they can tell that she is shifting the toddler from one hip to the other based upon the footprints. And every now and then she sets him down and he toddles alongside of her. Then she picks up the toddler again and then it's just her footprints for a while and she's clearly heavier and shifted to one side. Ooh. Then she puts him down again. Any parent can, you know, I think relate to that.
Yeah, right.
Kind of scenario.
You're eating too much caribou, kid.
So the question is, what's the date of all of those footprints?
Yeah, that's the question.
Right, those human footprints. So a study came out in 2021 that dated these seeds embedded in the fossilized footprints. So the cool thing about this is that this is not an artifact in a media that we then date, which is fine, except that when you do that, like if you're dating the soil in which a bone is found, you don't know how the bone got there.
Yeah.
And it may have mixed with deeper soil and it could be, the age could be artifactual. But if your date, if the fossil is the soil, then there's no question about that about how old the footprint is. It's as old as the media that the footprint is made out of. Mm. So these seeds were dated to between 21 and 23,000 years ago, pushing back by 7,000 years, the oldest evidence of humans in the Americas.
Oh my God.
That's huge. Of course, this was met with pretty extensive skepticism. The biggest problem with this line of evidence is because these seeds are from an aquatic plant. And you know how carbon dating works?
Yeah.
It's the ratio of, you know, carbon 14, and it assumes that you're fixing all of your carbon from the atmosphere, and then that starts the clock ticking. Mm-hmm. But if you're in the water, you're incorporating carbon from the water, which doesn't have the same ratio as the
carbon. No, and it's
carbon.
A huge sink. It could have, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's another variable that could be throwing off the date. So
God
now the news is a follow-up study with two additional dating methods. One, using carbon dating of pollen from land plants, so that eliminates the seawater problem. And another one, using optically stimulated luminescence. Have you heard of this, Bob?
I think you mentioned it. Like, I think, yeah. I talked about luminescence dating like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So I had to look it up just to like really wrap my head
right,
around
it. Right, because I didn't know anything about it either.
Yeah, so essentially certain crystals, like quartz, when light is shining on them, it shifts the electrons into a different state, right? The electrons get trapped by the sunlight. And then as soon as it's, so the last, when it's no longer exposed to sunlight, those trapped electrons start slowly shifting into a lower energy state. And so we can tell the last time that crystal was exposed to sunlight.
Right, the last time it was at the surface of the soil.
Exactly.
That's really cool.
So this was buried this many years ago, exactly. Yeah. So it's
Holy
at
crap,
least that old, right?
If not older,
yeah. It could be older, but it's at least that old. Then they have to stimulate the crystal and they measure the radiation, which tells them about the state of the electrons, right? I'm skipping over a lot of details because I don't understand them, but that's the press release level of sort of understanding it. But it's cool. It basically measures the last time it was exposed to sunlight. So these two methods both agreed on a date between 21 and 23,000 years ago. So
that's awesome.
This is pretty much a done deal.
That's pretty solid. Damn.
That's pretty. Multiple lines of evidence. People are like, well, yeah. I mean, you know, that's good. Good job. You have multiple independent lines of dating evidence. Can't really argue with that. So yeah, that's a long time ago. So of course, it's just footprints, right? No DNA. And so this creates more questions than it answers, obviously. So now we know that. So
all good science does.
Yeah, of course. So it's still a big puzzle that we're trying to unravel, the peopling of the Americas. So were these people, right, the White Sands people, were they Clovis people?
Right.
Did they become the Clovis culture? Did they
were
die
they
out?
Were they taken out by the
and
Clovis?
And get replaced by the Clovis people? Yeah, so how far did they
were
go?
Were they just passing through?
Right, you know, so yeah, we don't know. We really don't know. So we need a lot more data. You know, we just need more archaeological evidence, more paleontological evidence to really flesh out this story of people coming to the Americas. But it just got a lot more interesting. This is super cool.
Man. Very cool.
Definitely pre-Clovis people.
So, Steve, is there more evidence there, or that's pretty much it?
Well, I mean, there's more footprints, you know. And so keep in mind, they like basically dug a trench down to this time period to uncover these footprints and study them. And imagine there's this just layers of sand for the last 20, 30,000 years with millions of animal and human footprints all over the place to be studied. You know what I mean? Like there's a ton of science to be done with this window, you know, into the past through footprints. But maybe we'll find even older footprints that we could date, you know?
Yeah.
This story is not over. This is like at least 21,000 years ago, there were people in New Mexico, you know?
Very cool.
Yeah, very cool.
I love it. Something as fleeting as footprints just happened to get fossilized. It seems more, you know, more unlikely than any, like any organism or body being fossilized to have something like that.
And it's such a human story that's being told by footprints.
Right.
You know, there's also
behavior.
There's another patch where it's basically a group of teenagers standing on the edge of a lake. You know,
hanging out
on the edge of a lake.
Something.
Very, very cool. So, yeah, this is obviously a story that's being told over a very long period of time. All right, Jay, tell us about addictive foods.
So before I start, guys, is there a food that once you start eating it, you have trouble stopping yourself?
I guess like chips.
Steve, how about you?
I'm trying to think of one where that's not the case.
I think it's like, you know, that bitch can't eat just one. It's like small snacky things.
My thing is smart food. Smart food, like...
Yeah, that's crazy.
Oh, the popcorn?
As soon as I start eating it, I get kind of feverish about it, you know? Bob, yours is a peanut butter-based item, I would expect.
Yeah, I mean, my friend last year for Halloween, our Halloween party, brought me a box of my favorite candy bar, Reese's Crispy Crunchy. There was like a dozen of the extra large bars in there. And I tried to give them away. Nobody really was taking them. So I was left with like 10 bars. And over like 4 days, I ate every goddamn one.
Oh my God. All right. Well, right out of the gate, I want to say scientists who study this type of thing don't agree about whether there is an actual food addiction. You know, does it exist or not? And there isn't a consensus. Like the research is being done. More evidence is coming in. But we can't really say that there is definitely a quote unquote food addiction phenomenon happening, you know, because the word addiction means some specific things, right? It means that you have like a, you know, Steve, you would be better describing this than me, but in short, you know, is there an actual addictive pathway in the brain for food the way it would operate in other addictive drugs? You know, they don't know. They don't know.
Well,
yet.
Definitely appears to be different than, say, like heroin, right? But it depends on your definition of the word addictive. Do you include compulsive behavior or just things that have a physiological addiction?
Yeah, but there seems to be something legitimate happening that seems to be measurable. But again, you know,
there's still a dopamine response. I mean, there's still pathways involved. But yeah, sort of where's that threshold?
Yeah. Yeah, so it is a little fuzzy right now. So researchers at the University of Michigan ran a study that tried to answer what the most and least addictive foods are according to the Yale Food Addiction Scale, which is also known as YFAS, YFAS. So let me tell you what this is. So the Yale Food Addiction Scale, you know, it's widely recognized. It's a tool that was designed to evaluate addictive-like behaviors relating to food. And it's important to note, again, they're not saying that food addiction exists, that they are evaluating addictive-like behaviors that are just associated with eating food. And the scale includes a series of questions that help assess the severity of these behaviors, so, you know, researchers can better understand the extent to which, you know, people experience, like, quote unquote, symptoms of potential, you know, food addiction like behaviors. Right? It seems a little general, but they've created a scale to measure essentially, you know, people's response to certain foods. Now, in this study, researchers surveyed hundreds of participants, including undergraduate students. They also had people that they recruited online, and they were using the Yale Food Addiction Scale to identify which foods were most likely to trigger addictive-like responses. And there were some pretty, you know, pretty obvious results, and then other areas were pretty interesting. So, you know, right out of the gate, highly processed foods, obviously, ones that contained a lot of fat, refined carbohydrates, lots of sugar, white flour, these were strongly associated with addictive-like eating behaviors. Chocolate emerged as the most addictive food. There was, you know, a lot of other, like, one in four people essentially, like, said they have like an addiction-like relationship with chocolate. Other foods on the list included, you know, ice cream, French fries, pizza, cookies, chips. You know, they have a lot in common if you think about what they're made out of. There's a lot of commonality in that, and it's, you know, it seems obvious, right? Like, I think we could have named most of those if we were, you know, we're asked to name, you make a list of,
sure,
of addictive foods, you know, and partly because we all partake in it, you know, like, I know how great eating ice cream is, and I do have to just tell myself, stop eating it. You know, I don't get full when I eat ice cream. I just get disgusted with myself. You know what I mean?
Funny though, because it's like different people clearly have different, I guess,
reactions
to that. Like, I don't have that problem. I don't like, it's not that I get full. I just get tired of it. Like, if I sit down with a pint after I eat like a little bit of it, I'm like, okay, I feel done with this.
Yeah, that's good. That's a great response to have.
What is that?
And I've talked to other people who feel the same way.
Right. Like, I think there's a lot of people who feel this way. There's also a lot of people who don't. But, like, that's an interesting thing to me to study.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
So another food that was high on the list was breakfast cereals.
Oh, yeah. I could see that.
And these ranked higher than, like, items like soda or fried chicken. Like, breakfast cereals rated higher.
A lot of sugar in breakfast cereal.
It's a ton of sugar, and I don't think you get full. It's like fried chicken. You can only eat so much fried chicken, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, with cereal, I again, it's another one of those things where I'm like, I just limit myself to one bowl, you know, whatever. Even if it's like a pseudo healthy one, like Raisin Bran or something, it's still got a lot of sugar in it, you know, and I monitor my, you know, my intake of things like that. But, you know, I remember being a kid, I'd eat like four bowls of Captain Crunch.
Right. Yeah.
You know, just get deep into that box, you know? So, like I said earlier, and I think it's important to note, you know, there is no consensus in the scientific community about this. You know, I'm repeating that because I just want to make it perfectly clear. Like, you know, some people might, you know, might take offense or, you know, think we're saying something. You know, we are on a trajectory to really understanding much more about this. So when I use the word addiction, like, don't take it as like a full, like, equating it to drug addiction. So traditional addiction is typically associated with substances like, you know, alcohol or cocaine. You know, being addicted to food certainly does challenge our current definition. So while the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, right, this is the DSM-5, Carrie, you know all about that.
Mm-hmm.
This is considered the psychiatry Bible, right? It doesn't formally recognize food addiction. And the YFAS is based on, though, it's based on the DSM-5's criteria adapted for food-related behaviors. So they're taking into account research and conclusions that have been made in the DSM-5. And they're borrowing, you know, they're borrowing a lot from it, to be honest. Like, they're taking a lot of stuff that's already been identified there and kind of, you know, using it as a starting point, I guess, to figure out, like, what's going on with like, the food issues that we're seeing. And there are researchers in the field that they've suggested that sugar may be as addictive as some hard drugs like cocaine. You know, wow, if that's true, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, but I think that's a very strong statement to make. And it would be great if we knew for sure, like, what was going on in the brain. You know, maybe to some people, like, sugar really is, it does have addictive-like qualities, you know. They cited studies on rats that showed a preference for sugar and evidence of them going through sugar withdrawal. But these claims have limitations. You know, they're not universally accepted in the scientific community, whatever. It's all preliminary. Nonetheless, there is evidence, though, suggesting that sugar and highly processed foods can activate pleasure centers in the brain. Like, no duh, right? This is what we're talking about when you get, like, a dopamine hit. And overeating, they believe that there is, you get a dopamine rush when you overeat. And people who are more predisposed to addiction might find it challenging to control their consumptions of foods.
Do you think that maybe part of why it's so hard to categorize this separately, right? Because the DSM only categorizes substances. I think the five also has gambling disorder listed in it because there is some good evidence to show that it's like the only behavioral disorder that mirrors a lot of the neurological stuff that's going on with substance use. But when we talk about addiction or substance use disorders, we're talking about four categories. So impaired control, social problems, risky use, and physical dependence. And it's, you can't have a physical dependence to food because we all have a physical dependence to food because we have to eat.
Yeah, agreed. I totally agree. I mean, I think, you know, the parallels that they're making is that they're saying that people describe their relationship with food using addiction-related terminologies, cravings, withdrawal, loss of control. You know, there is some crossover here.
Right. But I don't think, like, that description of withdrawal, it would be really interesting to actually side-by-side compare what, like, a heroin withdrawal or a methamphetamine withdrawal or benzodiazepine withdrawal looks like in comparison to like a chocolate withdrawal.
Yeah, for sure.
Because at a certain point, it just goes into hunger.
They said, in summary, the current study found that highly processed foods with added amounts of fat and or refined carbohydrates like sugar and white flour, these were most likely to be associated with behavioral indicators of addictive-like eating. Additionally, foods with high glycemic index were especially related to addictive-like eating problems for individuals endorsing elevated symptoms of food addiction. So it's an interesting situation. I think, you know, again, a lot more research needs to be done. But it is good for all of us to be aware, you know, like have some awareness about the kinds of foods that you're eating, the behaviors that you have around certain foods.
Well, I think the idea is that, you know, we evolved in a very calorie limited environment, right? When basically for most of our existence, evolutionarily speaking, we were living on the brink of starvation, right? Mm-hmm. And when we had access to food, it was like, eat all you can when you can, because you don't know when you're going to get your next meal. And we crave fat, salt, you know, carbohydrates, because these are calorie dense foods. You know, we suck the bone marrow out of bones because that's really fatty and nutritious food. And now we live in developed worlds, we live in an environment where you have unlimited access to food that is designed to be as tasty as possible.
Yeah, you know, like scientifically.
It's like scientifically, it's the super sense
weaponized thing. Food.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we did not evolve to deal with this kind of constant overstimulation, you know, and it applies to more than just food. You know, like the whole gambling phenomenon is that, the pornography phenomenon is like that, you know, where we have these things in our world that we didn't have before. Like our brains are not adapted to this. And so we're eating like we're starving on the Serengeti, but we're surrounded by fat, sugar, and salt, you know.
Yep.
That's the problem.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, let's move on. Kara.
Yes.
Tell us about the latest application of CRISPR.
Ooh.
Yes. So there is a new study that was published in Nature Communications just a day ago as of this recording, titled Creating Resistance to Avian Influenza Infection Through Genome Editing of the ANP32 Gene Family. So what does that all mean? Well, using CRISPR-Cas9, a group of scientists out of Edinburgh, out of the Roslin Institute and Royal School of Veterinary Studies at the University of Edinburgh, have used CRISPR-Cas9 to genetically modify chickens to be resistant to bird flu. So this is like a big deal, right? So we're talking avian influenza. there are many, many different forms of avian influenza, but it's a pretty nasty, it can be a pretty nasty infection. So this is a group of flu viruses that spread in birds. Obviously, we've heard of different versions of it. You may have seen a lot of coverage over the last several years of H5N1, a specific subtype of H5N1, which has been particularly virulent, has spread pretty much in most of the continents on the globe and killed tons of farmed birds, but not just farm birds. It's out in the wild as well. And so we're seeing a lot of wild birds falling to this virus. And we also know that certain types of avian flu, even though for the most part, it's not really adapted to humans, certain types of bird flu can spill over. And it's only a small series of mutations that have to take place for human beings to be able to fall ill or even die from bird flus. And it's really kind of what a lot of epidemiologists have their eye on for the next big pandemic, right? So really, it's important to keep an eye on zoonotic infection, on spillover when it comes to bird flu. So it's just bad across the board. It's bad for human health, but it's also bad economically. It's bad for these animals. A lot of them have to be culled just because the infections get so rampant and it spreads so quickly that there's sort of no saving these chickens. And in order to save what chickens aren't infected, they have to sometimes quarantine or kill the infected birds. There have been vaccine campaigns, but it's not always feasible to vaccinate all of the different farm animals that we are trying to grow for food. It's also impossible to vaccinate wild birds. It just doesn't happen. And economically, it's not always, it's also not always viable. So basically, researchers have been trying to think, how can we get a handle on this? And they did a pretty ingenious thing where they were able to identify a gene that codes for a protein that they've known for a while about called ANP32. And it's got different subgroups, but it's the A subgroup, which is really, really important here. This is a necessary gene for the flu virus to proliferate. Like, it needs this gene and the protein that it codes for in order to produce more copies of itself. And so they were like, okay, if we go in there and we make it so that the virus can no longer bind to the protein by actually editing using CRISPR-Cas9, right? Like this very specific gene editing tool that we've talked about a million times on the show. By using CRISPR-Cas9, we can specifically go in and we can make a change to this coding region. And now the virus can't bind to the protein anymore. And so it can't replicate. And so they're like, we're going to do this. We're going to actually, it's really interesting reading about how they made these little kind of changes in vitro. And then they sort of knocked out the living embryos and injected these into the embryo so that these new chickens would be genetically modified. But basically, then they gave these genetically modified chickens avian flu. They took 10 genetically modified chickens and 10 control chickens. They gave them all doses of avian flu up the nose, so like a direct dose into the nasal cavity. In this kind of first pass, what they found was that I think something like 7 out of the 10 control birds got sick. And they also spread it to other birds that were within the vicinity. So just like you would expect when a bird is exposed directly to a viral load, only 1 out of the 10 gene-edited chickens got sick, and the viral load seemed to be low enough that it couldn't spread it to other chickens. So it sort of stopped that, that I guess what I would think of as like almost like a nucleation point, right? Or that sort of, that it put a hamper on it.
And that one chicken survived.
That one chicken, so I don't know if it ultimately, I don't know if any of them ultimately survived, you know, like the research animals. But yes, it got sick, but it didn't make other birds sick. And that's what's really, really important. Then they decided, okay, well, we need to push this because something's going on there where one bird still got sick. And we need to A, understand why. Let's look at the genetics. Let's see what's happening. And B, let's see what happens if we overload them with the virus. So then they actually exposed them to something like a 1,000 times higher dose than the birds would have ever had in a regular exposure. And when they gave the gene-edited chickens this 1,000 times higher dose, half the birds still got sick. And so they were like, this is interesting. But they shed lower levels of the virus and they spread it lower. So they were like, okay, why is this working, but it's only working up to a point? So they went into it and they realized that, you remember how I mentioned that there were other subtypes? So there's this ANP32A protein, but there's also a B and an E protein. And typically what we've understood the B and the E proteins to do had nothing to do with the A protein, but it looked like there were some redundancies, even though we typically think of those as being, I think the B is usually inactive in chickens and the E actually has antiviral proteins in chickens. They found that when the A was knocked out or not functioning appropriately, the B and the E were able to sort of pick up the role that the A proteins or subunits would usually use in making that protein. So clearly there is some sort of latent capability in the genetics, and this shows exactly what happens in evolution, right? This is what happens when we use antibiotics. This is what happens when we put pressure on an infectious agent within different host animals, is that they figure out a new way for that infectious agent to thrive. And so just like with a lot of GM work in plants, the researchers were saying, probably if we want to make, because this was a proof of concept study, probably if we want to make this widespread, we're going to need to do knockouts or alter the other subunits as well. Now, there's a little bit of problem with that, in that altering the subunit A is fine and dandy because it doesn't affect the health of the chickens, right? We're talking about farm animals. We're talking about a food source. If they don't thrive, this is a moot point. It's not going to help anybody. We don't care if it prevents them from getting bird flu if they don't ever develop. So A was fine, but apparently it's thought that affecting the A, B, and E is going to be detrimental to their health. So there may have to be some other way to get in there, another variation that researchers need to work on. So I think it's a really interesting study because A, it shows proof of concept. This can work, but it's not perfect out the gate. And B, it shows that ethical balance that we have to take, which is if I'm trying to induce or create a solution to the problem of viral transmission of a potentially zoonotic pathogen that is like wildly detrimental to both farmed and wild bird species and potentially even humans, trying to fix it can sometimes have runaway consequences and make it worse. It can induce mutation and cause the virus to kind of spill over faster. So we have to be really, really careful when we start looking into these solutions. I think that they can be viable and they can be important, but we have to be careful about how we proceed. Yeah.
Yeah, but at least we have a tool, you know what I mean?
It's the first time this has ever been done.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously
this is cool.
There's definitely the potential for bad things to happen, but it's worse to be sitting on the sidelines helpless in the face of a bird flu pandemic, which could be devastating.
Completely. Yeah. And you think about how important the global food supply is and mm-hmm. why these are like literally, I don't mean pun unintended, but like sitting ducks for this. Like it is, you know, it seems silly talking about like gene editing birds, but we're talking about gene editing food birds. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the important. We're talking about chickens that are raised for food that, you know, these aren't wild caught animals. These are animals that are already coming from a particular stock. And so bringing them from a particular gene edited stock actually isn't that big of a jump when you think about it, especially if we have all those checks and balances in place and there's multiple genes that have been edited. So there are redundancies worked into the system.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Kara.
Cool. Yep.
Bob, tell us about super heavy elements.
Ooh.
All right, so scientists recently reported on their research of hypothetical superheavy elements to see what the characteristics of matter might be if it exists beyond the known elements in the periodic table, okay? This was published in the European Physical Journal Plus by physicists from the University of Arizona, Evan LaForge, Will Price, and Johan Rawalsky. This fascinated the shit out of me, but there are some problems as far as I could tell. I'll go into them. So what are these guys claiming? Well, as usual, before that, let's delve into some background first. about it's about the area beyond the current outer edges of our beloved periodic table of elements, specifically the super heavy elements, that end of the table. Super heavy elements are not made in stars or supernovae or kilonovae. They have to be made synthetically in a lab. So at this super heavy end, the number of protons in the nucleus, otherwise known as?
Oh, the atomic number?
Yes, very good.
I was like, I know this, wait.
The atomic number at this end is getting really high at this point. Typically, super heavies are, you know, if there's a, greater than 100 or 104 protons in the nucleus. And we have created and named elements with 105 protons up to 118 or so. But these super heavies have short half-lives since they're unstable and they're radioactive as well. So, yeah, I mean, they're fascinating and interesting, but they're kind of like, you know, laboratory curiosities really with no real practical use as a material, right? So elements with atomic numbers beyond 118 have not been observed, but they've always fascinated me, and some predictions are tantalizing. For example, some think that, there could be a so-called island of stability around 164 protons, meaning that elements with that amount of protons or near, around that could have isotopes that potentially last far longer than the other super heavy elements. Does that mean what? What does that mean? That they could last for minutes, or more usefully, I would think it could be months, years, or even far longer. Potentially, who knows? Doesn't seem incredibly likely, but that would always out there as a possibility, which is fascinating to me. So this is where these researchers come in. They call super heavy elements with an atomic number greater than 118 hyperheavies. I like that. And they wanted to explore what could be learned about such potential elements. Specifically, they wanted to know how dense can such matter be without having to resort to even more bizarre types of matter like dark matter or strange matter. They wanted to just to know like common matter on the periodic table, even if it's beyond what we know. How heavy could that be? How dense could it get? So now they say that this could explain some asteroids that they claim are compact ultra-dense objects, or CUDOs, C-U-D-O-S, compact ultra-dense objects. Now, this is where they lose me. not sure why they did this. The researchers say that there are some asteroids, apparently, that appear denser than the most dense stable element we know. What do you guys – I'd be kind of surprised if anyone knew the densest naturally occurring stable element is osmium. O-S-M-I-U-M, osmium. Osmium is a rare metal. Its atomic number is 76. It's got a density of 22.59 grams per cubic centimeter. That's twice the density of lead. So that is some dense shit right there. That's dense, heavy, 22.5 grams per cubic centimeter. So here's a quote from their paper. Our study of mass density is motivated by the possibility of compact ultra-dense objects, CUDOs, which we define here as objects, typically astronomical bodies, which have a mass density greater than that of osmium, the element with the largest experimentally measured mass density. In particular, some observed asteroids surpass the mass density threshold. Especially noteworthy is the asteroid 33 Polyhymnia. Based on mass and size measurements obtained from independent sources, its mass density is computed as 75.3 plus or minus 9.6 grams per cubic centimeter. 75, over three times that of osmium, based on this one asteroid. So apparently this asteroid is three times denser than the densest natural material that we know of. And this is what they're saying. The problem is, it does not seem generally accepted by scientists that asteroid 33 Polyhymnia is in fact denser than osmium. It's like kind of like not a thing, apparently. Even the scientist who they cite in their paper, the scientist who calculated this density that they are talking about, describes his calculation as unrealistic, quote unquote, unrealistic, the guy that they're quoting. Okay, so the most likely explanation seems to be simply it's an erroneous measurement. The guy who made the measurement says it's not realistic.
Either that or it's an alien spacecraft.
Right. Nobody's saying that, Steve. Be quiet. Also, I love also I love this this rule of thumb for many wild claims. If there really was decent evidence that an asteroid was three times denser than osmium, that would be a well-known major discovery that many people would know, and I probably already would have talked about it on the show multiple times. So it's kind of like it's not a thing. And they weren't just saying this one asteroid. They were saying multiple asteroids have been, in fact, calculated to have a density greater than osmium. But Polyhymnia apparently is the most conclusive. But I don't think it's a thing. And it's really disappointing that they even threw that in there. But all that said, though, the research is still interesting. And anyway, I think the researchers seem to essentially want to know if such a density is even plausible. That's like their overriding goal here. They want to know, is this plausible with normal type matter? So you can kind of disregard this whole thing with the asteroids, but it still kind of gets under my skin. Okay, so for their research, they used a model called the Thomas Fermi model of atomic structure. They used this to try and tease out some information about such possible hyper heavy elements. What are the properties? Researcher Rafalsky said, "We chose this model despite its relative imprecision because it allows the synthetic exploration of atomic behavior as a function of atomic number beyond the known periodic table." So this model seemed like a good tool to extend our knowledge as far as we could in terms of elements with atomic numbers far beyond, you know, beyond 118. Number crunching using this model, they came back with that it supported the prediction that there could be an island of stability for super heavy elements with an atomic number around 164. So that was encouraging. I always loved the idea of this island of stability, and this model that they used kind of seemed like that seems potentially plausible. Further, they suggested that such stable hyper-heavy elements could have a density range near 68 grams per cubic centimeter. Remember, osmium was like, 22? So they're saying that, a hyper-heavy element near 168 atomic number would have potentially near 68 grams per cubic centimeter, and that is near the measured density of asteroid 33 Polyhymnia, which of course I don't believe. So that's kind of like whatever. So the bottom line here seems to be that these researchers potentially have a useful tool for exploring the structure and properties of extreme hyper-heavy elements that might one day appear on our periodic table of elements. It could take quite a while before that happens, but they could potentially be there. I think we should absolutely explore this tool more to see how useful it really is. But if you want to use this tool to specifically learn more about so-called compact ultra-dense objects, please have some serious evidence that they actually exist first before you start yeah. writing about it. It's like, oh, look at this cool problem. Let's solve it. Well, wait a second. The problem's not there. The mystery's not there. When I first was reading this, Steve, have you ever read – I've never read about anything about compact ultra-dense objects before.
No.
And I never – when I read in this article that there are asteroids out there that are denser than osmium, I'm like, what? How could I possibly have not known that? That is a huge, huge mystery and something amazing that would be, written about in a way that we would all have heard about it. So then, of course, as I got into the weeds and read more, I'm like, yeah, it's really probably not even a thing at all. But still, this was interesting, exploring the potential of the periodic table of elements and, elements, these hyper-heavies, is fascinating. And, at the very least, you could use this information to make your hard science fiction, a little bit harder if you're talking about this. And, I mean, what interests me about this as well is that, these elements could, there could be alien civilizations out there that are routinely creating these. Who knows? That would be fascinating, but it's interesting to think about. Yeah, what do you think?
I mean, I think the idea of an asteroid with three times denser than the densest is just silly. It's
like, nuts.
Yeah.
Three times. I mean,
the laws of physics, I think, would have something to say about that. I would be shocked if that turned out to be the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But if they do find at some point in the future a true compact ultra-dense object that gave credence to the idea of a stable element with a huge atomic number. Mm-hmm. That would be that would be amazing, you know, Nobel Prize winning discovery. Probably won't happen, or at least definitely not in our lifetimes. But I just love thinking about it.
All right, I'm going to do another quick news item. Have you heard of Bob of using tree ring data to date ancient solar flares or solar storms?
I think so. Yeah, that doesn't sound too crazy, right?
Yeah, so what happens, here's the backstory. You know, carbon-14 dating is based upon the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 in the atmosphere, which gets incorporated into living things like in trees, and we could date them based upon the tree rings. Carbon-14 is made out of nitrogen-14 when it gets hit by a cosmic ray or a high-energy particle. And if there is like a coronal mass ejection or a very powerful solar flare that hits the Earth, that can cause a pulse of carbon-14 in the atmosphere. And if that is followed by a period of minimal solar activity, which it can happen, then that reduces the solar wind, which increases cosmic rays, which then can cause years of a increase in the background C14 level. Right? You have increased cosmic rays, increased carbon-14 because of decreased solar activity. So you get a pulse, and then you may be followed by even up to like a century of a baseline increase in the amount of carbon-14. So that's the kind of signal we're talking about. So we see one, for example, corresponding to the Carrington event, which we've talked about many times on the show.
Yes.
Well, new data shows the biggest such spike 14,000 years ago.
Ooh, how big?
10 times stronger than Carrington.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that was a big one.
It's a big one.
Yeah, I mean, so that would, yeah, that could potentially wipe out our electrical grid. You know, that's something that
big. Order of magnitude greater than the Carrington event. But they had to go back 14,000 years?
Yeah, so what they found is that when you gather all this data, yes, 14,000 years ago, or kilo-years ago. So they found that there were, in the last 14,000 years, there's about one every 1,200 years or so.
At that, what?
But it's random. It's random. Yeah, well, like Carrington level event. That was the biggest one, but there are big spikes. There are spikes, but yeah, there's definitely a big solar flare that hit the Earth around this time. And they said, so the on average, the risk of it happening each decade is about 1%. That's, you know, it's not negligible. 1% per decade of that level of event.
Does that jive? Remember we talked about this like a four or five years ago. We talked about this specifically, and I think the conclusion was that within 20 years, the chance of having a Carrington level or a significant level was like dramatically.
It was like 10% or something. Yeah, yeah, I think this was a lot less. I thought of that too. This seems lower than what we previously reported.
Which is a little encouraging.
Yeah, but still, 1% per decade is not negligible, and it definitely sounds like something we need to be prepared for.
Oh, yeah. It's still, I think, one of the most likely ways that civilization will take a huge hit.
We'll take a hit, yeah. I'm not going to say end, but we'll take a hit.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, imagine a blackout for a decade, you know, that kind of thing. You know, Right. That would be significant. That would be a significant disruption to our delicate
dogs and cats living together. Total chaos.
Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, this kind of evidence, and it's pretty well established that that's what we're seeing. That's what this evidence represents. And it seems pretty, these are random events, but statistically, you know, we have a pretty good beat on how often this happens.
Now, Steve, do they need to distinguish between a solar flare and a coronal mass ejection or a potential coronal, what is it called, a surface ejection? Are they, you know, they kind of like, you know, treating that as similar things?
Yeah, I don't think they could tell the difference with this kind of data. There's a carbon-14 spike. That's it.
Okay.
So something happened which increased cosmic rays. So yeah, anyway, so that's it. This is a short one. Just we have a record of these events. Hopefully we won't see one soon. We need to harden our grid against
it. Yes.
And the thing really know what would happen, and it's a continuum. You could say, okay, well, if a Carrington level event hit, what would happen?
Right.
But you might get one stronger than that, And so, and even still, we really, really don't know exactly how bad it would be.
Yeah.
But we have not specifically hardened our grid against such an event or our satellites. Some satellites are hardened to some degree, but we have tremendous infrastructure at risk for this kind of event.
What are they calling it, Steve? Did they, because I like, Carrington event. What, they need a name for this.
Yeah, I didn't
see. The biggest one ever discovered. They need a name.
I didn't see a name.
All right, let's work on that.
The thing that scares me about this, it's kind of like global warming. What's it going to take? At what point do we invest the serious amount of money that we need to in order to solve some of these problems and harden our grid? Hopefully when we're updating the grid because of the electrification that's going on, that they're going to take this into account while they're doing it, right?
Yeah, that'd be nice, but don't hold your breath.
But that's giving governments too much credit.
We generally will react after it happens, and people will say, why didn't we do anything? Who could have predicted this was going to happen,
Yeah, like people talking about the pandemic 10 years ago. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. We had a infectious disease specialist, Mark Crislip, on the show like 15 years ago, and he basically laid out the pandemic. Less he said, this that, is what's going to happen. He said, stock up on toilet paper.
Yeah, people listen to the show, listen to the older show from, I think it was like 2012, Steve, or 2013 and they're like, it's eerie how close he was.
Because the experts knew exactly what was going to happen, pretty much.
Yep.
It's the same thing here. Like, we'll get hit with an event, and there's going to be a paper trail of experts saying, "Yeah, this is pretty much what we figured was going to happen. This is within the error bars of what we figured." But everyone will act like we got taken by surprise.
Steve, I'm also curious how they could distinguish between a solar flare, but also like maybe a nearby supernova or some other astronomical event that could also explain the increased carbon-14. It seemed like they just jumped to the solar flare. I guess it seems that's probably the most likely explanation based on the evidence.
I think because we know from historical events, like we know you have the Carrington event as a reference.
Yeah.
But we don't have any of these other events as a reference.
True. True. All right.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys. Last week I played this noisy. So I had a lot of people guess this one right, which was fun because I figured they would once you find out what it is. Okay, guys, I have a guess from a listener named Brianna Beeble. Hi, I'm going to guess that this week's Who's That Noisy is a quarter machine like at the laundromat, like the one that keeps overflowing when I try to take the quarters out and then I have to go chasing quarters across the floor. Thanks for a great show, as always. Yeah, I've used quarter machines. I've used machines like that, soda machines and stuff like that. But I've never had one like overspill with quarters. I have heard coins come out of like a one-armed bandit at a casino. So there is a little similarity there. I could hear that for sure. Edward Myers wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, this noisy sounds like a bunch of dominoes being toppled." And there is like a clicking, that clicking noise that dominoes make when they go. Yeah, there's a little bit of that in there too. But we could do better than that, right? Michael Blaney wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay. I'm glad I didn't have my volume up too high. My guess is hail on a tin roof." And I haven't heard hail on a tin roof, but I've heard hail on the roof of my car. And yes, it has like that repetitive type of thing going on there. Let's get to another guest here from Danilo Escobar. "Hello, Jay. I have a guest for my two boys. So Gail, who is age 8, said it's a tree going through a wood chipper, and Kai, who's 6, said it's ice getting crunched into little pieces." Well, good try, guys. Definitely keep trying to guess. Every time you try to guess what Who's That Noisy is, you get just a little bit smarter. But let's get to the answer. The answer is, the winner for this week is a listener named Aaron Sharp. And Aaron said, "Hi, skeptical people. I'm Aaron from Central Illinois. I don't know why, but hearing the mechanical squeaks and the crunchy sounds made me think of the old coffee grinder my family has had in the basement for decades." And that's his final answer. Essentially, this is a hand crank coffee grinder that a lot of people used to have many decades ago. It wasn't uncommon for people to have some type of, you know, like a hand crank machine that they would use to grind their own coffee. You know, this is before we had electric coffee grinders, or, you know, people shifted at one point to buying ground coffee in the stores. So these hand crank coffee grinders predates all of that happening. So they go back pretty far. But listen again real quick. I won't play the whole thing, but just so you can get an idea. Right, it has like a circular kind of sound to it.
I thought it had like a circular sound to it, yeah.
Doesn't sound like they're grinding a lot of coffee beans, though.
Yeah, it's not a fast process, Bob. I saw a video of somebody do it, and it's like, you know, it takes a little while to get it done. So I have a new noisy for you guys this week. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Michael Stoll. Let's see what you think. All right, my hint is that this might be, I think that this is a broken version of the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that helps anybody. And I will give you another hint because I think this one is very difficult. It's something that's old. If you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something cool, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Real quick, Steve, we got Nauticon coming up November 3rd and 4th. There is still some tickets left. You can go to nauticoncon.com to see what's available. And we just to remind you guys, we are going to be doing a live Boomer versus Zoomer. That's our game show. We'll be doing that on Friday night at the conference, and on Saturday night at the conference, George Traub and Brian Wecht will be performing a live 80s, an insane 80s sing-along. That's what they call it, which is going to be a ton of fun. So please do consider joining us. It's not too late. You can still make it. You can still do it. Why aren't you going if you're not? That's the question.
All right. Thanks, Jay. One quick email. This comes from Tom, and Tom writes, "I was literally screaming at y'all on the podcast as I listened to it in my car yesterday during Science or Fiction, as you considered whether four Nobel laureates won their award while they were imprisoned. Hello, like the one who literally just won, Narges Mohammadi, who sits at this moment in an Iranian prison. I realize now that I have the benefit of the podcast time delay, and that at the time you recorded episode 952, the 2023 Peace Prize winner hadn't yet been announced. How ironic that events in just a few days between when you recorded the podcast and when it was released actually invalidated your science item and made it fiction. You should announce a correction, or maybe acknowledgement is more appropriate in fairness to you, that there are now five Nobel laureates who won their award while imprisoned." Yes, Tom, that's correct. In fact, right after the award was announced, Kara sent me an email, sent everybody an email, pointing out the irony of the fact that the Science or Fiction is not wrong. It was right at the time. It just became obsolete between the recording and the posting of the podcast, which I think it's the only time that's happened. Not that much of a coincidence, considering the fact that we were reporting in the middle of the Nobel Awards being given out. But yeah, that was funny. Yes, always remember the time delay. That's why I say the date that we are recording the show. Because lots of times we're talking about things that are breaking news, and the story evolves by the time the show comes out, you know?
Yeah.
This isn't the first time that someone's emailed us without realizing the time delay thing. Well, he did sort of halfway through the email.
I love watching emails evolve when people
Oh, never mind. Like, yeah, I just heard the rest of the piece. Yeah. All right, guys, so we have a fun interview coming up with Dan Friesen and Jordan Holmes from the Knowledge Fight podcast. So let's go to that interview now. Joining us now are Dan Friesen and Jordan Holmes. Guys, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, hello. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
You guys do the Knowledge Fight podcast, dedicated to critiquing Alex Jones' InfoWars and other conspiracy theorists. You've been doing this since 2017. What made you guys decide that you wanted to start a podcast about this?
Well, I think it starts with me, I guess, and then I infected Jordan.
No,
a
it's a
bit.
Fairly dramatic story, and I think you should give it the gravitas it deserves.
Me and Jordan were both like stand-ups, and we'd met each other and hit it off famously, and so that was sort of the in the background. And at the time, the kernel of the what happened was in the 2016 election. I made a very critical error. And that is that I started watching InfoWars coverage of the debates.
Ah.
So instead of watching Hillary and Trump, I would watch InfoWars personalities watch the debates and yell over them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It would be. It's like, remember when everybody saw Trump like hovering behind Hillary in the debate, and everyone was like, "Oh, this is an example of how, you know,
it's terrifying."
On InfoWars, they're like, "He's gonna get her now. From the top rope."
Yeah, it's such another universe.
Yeah, and I'd been sort of interested in that already at that point. I'd watched a bit of him, and he didn't seem like how I remembered him from the, like, you know, 9/11 conspiracy days. Something felt different, and so I was drawn to watching more of it and seeing what the hell was going on with this guy. And so I watched the debates, and then the election night coverage was like, well, I got to watch it on InfoWars. I've gone this far. And watching it on InfoWars was a really, like, awful experience because Trump wins, and that's a bummer. Yeah. And then at the same time, they're all celebrating with champagne toasts, and they're mocking the Hillary Clinton supporters who, you know, these are a diverse crowd of people who are all crying and recognizing that their rights were now in jeopardy. And you had just a bunch of weird white dudes who were real angry sitting around toasting champagne, laughing at these people crying. And I realized, like, I feel like I got to look more, even more into this. Yeah. I got to do something.
Someone's got to deal with whatever this
Someone's
is.
Someone's got to sort this mess
out. Yeah.
And so I just started doing that. And I thought we were just going to make fun of him. Honestly, like, I thought that was what we were going to do.
We started I'll tell you why we can back that up. Right. When we started, we spent plenty of time drinking on the show.
Totally.
We were like, hey, this is us making fun of a lunatic. Why not have a couple of drinks?
Yeah.
No big deal.
It was more or less an excuse for us to hang out.
Yeah, we love hanging out.
And at the same time, learn a little bit more, but like, about this person who we just sort of determined was crazy and we didn't know enough about. And,
totally.
Over the course of the time doing the show, like within the first year or so, it started to become clear that there was way more problems in his rhetoric and in the show as it existed, that we needed to take it a little bit more seriously. And so the show kind of evolved from that point where the mockery became trying to deconstruct. And it's been a learning process along the way of, like, how to do that.
Yeah.
So what surprised you the most? Like, what did you learn about, like, the whole Alex Jones phenomenon that surprised you from the time when you started out this project?
I feel like Jordan's best to answer this because you're the one who gets to experience the surprise the most.
Yeah. I mean, there's the obvious ironic answer, which is very complicated and yet so straightforward, which is that Alex is a liar.
Right.
You know, like, I have learned over the course of 850 odd episodes what you know instinctively just watching the dude talk, right? But the difference there is that the perception of Alex's lies throughout our culture is so superficial that it hides the depth of how truly horrific his lies can be. And so it is fascinating to see people, like, almost deceived by a liar in the way of them recognizing they're a liar.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the opinion we had going in, almost.
Yeah.
It's like you're just like, he's a liar, but there's something fun and
totally,
you know, and you came to a more evolved.
Yeah. It's a Matryoshka doll of eventually you go from, like, oh, he's turning the frogs gay, which everybody likes to reference. It's an enjoyable thing. We all go, ha, 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 how silly that is. Mm-hmm. And then you get down to it and you're like, wait a second. I did not remember that the civil rights were the fucking cause of communism. And now we're all going to die because Jewish people exist. I didn't remember that part.
Yeah, that wasn't as apparent at the beginning.
Yeah.
You kind of have to listen to a bit of his actual content to start to get these trends. And start to understand what belies or what's behind a lot of the information that he presents.
Yeah.
And, you know, that kind of sucks because, honestly, as someone who does it, it sucks to watch his show. It's a bad show.
Well, that can I ask then, you guys? I'm just so curious. Like, how?
No!
How do you maintain your perspective and your sanity, and like, how does this not like deeply affect your mental health?
I just screamed no at you. Yeah. So let's before we get into how do you maintain your sanity,
I feel like it's that scene in Avengers where the Hulk is like, my secret is I'm always mad. It's like that. I'm always crazy. That's the secret.
You didn't realize we were nuts before we ever even started this shit.
Do you actually get depressed, like, or worried, or like, do you have an existential kind of response? Has it ever deeply gotten to you?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think the first night, that night watching the election coverage on InfoWars is still a deeply like visceral moment that I can recall. But yeah, it gets dark. I think just our last episode before, you know, we're doing this interview was about the attack on Israel.
Yeah.
And Alex did a special report. He broke into Saturday. He doesn't usually do episodes on Saturday, so he did a special report to cover it. And halfway through, he switched into an infomercial for his book. He has a new book coming out. And so like that depressed me incredibly. Yeah. It's so bleak and cynical. And
listen to your own silence.
Yeah.
Listen to all of your fake gasps. You can't believe that shit.
It's
insane. Yeah.
It's horrifying to see somebody who can operate that way. And recognizing it and seeing it is often a pretty depressing thing. But like I said, Jordan and I are people who have both had experience for most of our lives with mental health issues, and we've had a lot of coping mechanisms that we've learned to develop through therapy and what have you. So it's easy to check ourselves, I think, whenever those feelings are becoming pronounced. So the answer is yes, but it doesn't always descend into despair.
Mm-hmm. It is a little bit along, you know, like I'm bipolar type one. So this is a little bit of like when the world gets insane, the insane turn pro, that kind of situation, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, I can imagine that some people can become very easily. I mean, obviously he has like cult followers, and clearly you set out for an intention, but have you ever been watching and been like, oh, he makes a good point? Have you ever caught yourself believing what he was spinning?
He does sometimes, but a lot of the times it's not important, the good points that he makes.
And that right. also, but that also brings us back to what we learned about him being a liar.
Right.
You know, you hear him make a good point, and it is, and I go back to like during the trial, whenever he had the...
You're talking about the Sandy Hook, Texas trial.
The Sandy Hook, Texas trial. While we were there, and one of the things that I kept harping on was the media kept being like, Alex Jones apologized for his behavior. For the first time, which is wrong on so many levels, not least of which because it's not the first time, and also because he wasn't really apologizing. He was just saying the words of an apology.
Yeah,
so when you hear him make a good point, he's not making a good point. He is saying the words of a good point.
Yeah, the cliche example that we've used over the years we've done the show is that, like, early on, some of the positions that he had that we found that were like, hey, that's a good position. Yeah. Or like, he was in favor of drug legalization, and he was strongly opposed to civil asset forfeiture.
Yeah.
And both of these positions are things that's like, well, I hate Alex Jones, but I agree on those things. You can't like say that those are wrong because he believes in them.
Yeah.
And then over time, we've seen him revert on both of them.
Yeah. Mm.
And so it's like, well, you never really meant it to begin with. There wasn't a principle here.
Yeah.
There was just this felt like the right thing to do at the time.
Yep.
Now, have you seen over the 6 years of covering him so closely that he's had any kind of an arc? Like, what's been the evolution of Alex Jones?
That's such a good question.
Well, actually, I think it's broader than that, because in the time that we've been covering him, I've also been going back and listening to his shows from, you know, as far back as like 2002. And so there's a bigger arc to him that I've been able to observe. And it's not a good picture, certainly. No. It's not a man who's thriving. It's a tale of self destruction in some ways. It's a guy who's a liar and doesn't really know that much about the subject that he's covering, get worse at his job over time, to the point where that illusion is far less convincing.
I would put it as almost like if you rewrote Faust with starring Mr. Magoo, you know, like he didn't even know he made a deal with the devil. He was just walking forward throughout. All these people are dropping beams and shit, and he just keeps walking forward, just like, if I keep being racist, it'll be fine. And it was.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So here's my question, because with con artists, right, sometimes we can, like, we, the ones that we've maybe followed over years too, not this closely, but just sort of more peripherally. So sometimes you could see them getting better at being a con artist over time. And then you go back to their early days, they just weren't as slick or polished at the con. But sometimes, like with, what's the nail lady? You know, the psychic with the nails. I'm forgetting her name.
The kid's dead.
The nail lady.
You know,
I'm so happy I forgot.
Sylvia Brown. Sorry, Sylvia Brown. Like, when Sylvia Brown got lazy because she knew it didn't matter. She could be worse at doing what she was doing. Are you saying that Alex Jones was falling?
When you're the nail lady, everything looks like a lady. Okay.
Yeah.
What you're describing is exactly right.
Yeah.
He got lazy because he realized, I could say, really, I don't even have to work. I could phone it in, just rant crazy stuff, and it'll work.
I think at a certain point, he recognized that his brand was essentially emotion-based and, like, creating feelings in the audience.
Yeah.
And he can do that without even really doing any work, and so why try? And then at the same time, he, like, came into these businesses that are so profitable that he was making money hand over fist, and it just, who cares? Why care that much?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think his scams are now not even scams. They're just like, he just is
hostage
yelling.
Hostage negotiation.
Yeah, he's just yelling at people for money all the time.
If it's you love even the country, give me money!
Yeah, there's very little craft to it.
Yeah. I mean, in a certain sense, you could say that he's lost the polish. In another way, perhaps you could say, like, there's no need for it. So why do you know, like, if you're a sprinter and everybody's like, oh, look at the great style you have, but if it doesn't make you go any faster, then just be as economical and as efficient with your movements as you can.
Yeah.
You know, so it's almost like a natural progression of how easy it is to do things that they get lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but his brand is incoherent, right? So he found, I could be incoherent by just not trying. Okay,
but isn't his brand also just like, be afraid of everything and buy my shit because I'm the only person who can save you from it?
Yeah, that is a lot of it. And I think that it's pretty easy to evoke those fear responses in an audience. Probably even before, but especially after COVID.
Yeah.
It's elementary the way he can do that. You don't really have to try that hard.
But his brand is also, I will show up as J.K. Simmons and Spider-Man. You know, his brand is that too. Mm-hmm. His brand is not just all of those things. His brand culturally is a foothold as the, like, almost avatar of the guy on the sidewalk screaming at you.
And the fact that he does show up in places like being J. Jonah Jameson and,
right,
and Spider-Man is that unfortunately feeds into his brand too, because like they need to make fun of me on such a high level,
right,
because I'm so right about the things I'm saying. Now granted, all the things he's saying are dumb.
Yeah.
But, you know, it does feed into people's perceptions about him that, yeah, he is dangerous. He's so dangerous that they have to assassinate his character in giant blockbusters.
No, it is a bit like, unfortunately, the culture gave him a slot, and until the culture recognizes that we gave it to him, and he wasn't, he's not supposed to have it. It's not like his.
I think it's a little too late to take that away.
Exactly.
But
yeah, I was going to say, do you feel like you guys contribute to that?
I think I hope not.
And if he had ever spoken about us, I would have a completely different answer.
Yeah.
If he, genuinely, if he had ever, because we can never know that from our perspective, like looking out, we'll always be uncertain of that.
Yeah.
But the big piece of evidence for me is if we can contribute to somebody else's success, they will use that.
That is true.
And Alex has never once used us.
And it's glaring because he complains about, like, small blogs that talk shit about
totally.
Him. And stuff like this. And we've done, like, 850 episodes of a podcast about him. We just toured the UK doing shows about him.
Yeah.
It's kind of absurd that something like this could exist and he doesn't, like, talk about it ever. Yeah. Like, considering that I was a expert consultant for the Texas Sandy Hook case, I was in one of the depositions that he gave. I was in the room with him. His producer emailed us asking him for us to have him on the show.
Yeah.
His lawyers complained about us in a bankruptcy hearing.
Yep.
So, like, there's a very, and one of
his, that's the other thing.
His main writer used to follow us on Twitter.
Yep.
And so, like, there's a obvious
He knows who you are.
Yeah. There's a very obvious awareness of who we are.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think that we can be confident that we are a negative because we never come up.
At the very least, this is a story that I think we should probably dine out on more, but we're just ourselves.
Oh.
We covered the depositions that all of the InfoWars employees had for the Sandy Hook trial, in not all of them, but for
most
both
of
Texas
the,
and Connecticut, right?
The ones that we could get our hands on.
So multiple depositions were for Rob Dew as the corporate representative of InfoWars. And to give a slight background, all right, just to give you some legalese, the corporate representative is the person who is supposed to know what the corporation knows.
They speak as the business, not as themselves.
Not a person who's like, oh, I might not know that because I just don't remember. It is the business has to know what the business does, right? They have records of that. Mm-hmm. So they did multiple depositions, all of which Rob Dew was so horrifically unprepared for. And we mocked so mercilessly that eventually the next deposition, they had a different corporate representative.
That was Daria. And I was actually there physically in the room for that one.
Yeah.
It was horrifying.
And we mocked that so miserably that there was another corporate representative.
They had to hire somebody from outside the company.
to represent the company.
Yes.
And Norm Pattis, Alex's lawyer, has said on the record
specifically
that the reason was they couldn't get anybody else from inside the company to agree to do it because they didn't want to get made fun of.
So nice. At the very least, not only have we not contributed to his success, but we have cost them roughly $30,000.
That's actually pretty damn good.
Yeah.
We helped with the lawsuit and all that stuff, but 30 grand directly to our bank account.
I think that there is a danger what you're asking about too, that of us like raising the profile of Alex in some ways. And I'm constantly aware of that.
Yeah.
But I do think that the way that we analyze his content and the poison pill of our podcast, I don't think that anybody could become aware of him through our show and then be like, this guy sounds pretty cool. I'm going to check him out.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not a gateway to listening to InfoWars.
I would hope not. I've not heard that from anybody. So,
but it is tricky. Crossed. We face that as well. It's like, you know, do we debunk this guy or are we just going to be raising their profile?
Right.
So we have to put things through that filter as well.
Yeah.
And the thing
there's
is,
some things that I try not to cover, not on Alex's show, but some people who have come up, like who've been suggested as like, this is someone you should cover. Like, no, I don't think that's wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. The controversy is better than obscurity, right? So
if
they pick a fight with a skeptic or a critical show or whatever, that just raises their profile.
Right. Like, yeah. If Alex was a no-name person and wasn't a multimillionaire who, you know, is friends with, not really friends with Trump, but he can pretend, but, like, friends with Tucker and Joe Rogan and all these people, then I don't think I would want to cover him. The damage is done in terms of his popularity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly.
Well, that's why I was so, like, it's funny because I remember, Jordan, I was sitting across from you a few weeks at QED and or at the diner outside of it, and we were talking, and you guys were saying that you were on tour with your podcast in the UK. And I was like, people in the UK know who Alex Jones is? And you were like, is that a serious question? It's like, no, really. I had no idea that his profile was global.
Yeah.
Because and I think he's, part of that- he's such a special American brand of crazy.
It's true, but I think that that's been exported a little bit,
too.
You know, you have in the UK, you have UKIP, and, you know, Nigel Farage is somebody who is very closely associated with Alex. He's been on InfoWars over the years. Paul Joseph Watson, I don't know how relevant of a figure he is in the UK itself, but he was swinging with these UKIP politicians. And, you know, there's Tommy Robinson is an agitator in the UK, and he... is a InfoWars regular. Not so much anymore, but he used to be. And
yeah, I would say I would defy you to find a media market that could not claim, like, oh, we have our Alex Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter if and you're a lot in Nigeria
of them, a lot of
in...
them end up being guests on Alex's show.
Totally,
because
yeah.
of that desire to create this solidarity or camaraderie between international shitheads.
Because it's not, I mean, what he does is a templatable, like, repeatable thing. He's just uniquely good at it.
Probably because of brain damage.
That's, well, I mean, there is, that's also kind of one of the speculations that we have.
Does he talk about the money that he owes in any way?
Nah, he pretends that he's winning the bankruptcy situation. He gives the audience a real flawed version of what's actually going on. He claims that he's in this bankruptcy reorganization process and everything's going great. And the courts, they realize that he's right and that he's going to just be able to make it through this reorganization. And, you know, they'll be able to stay on air. Maybe the Sandy Hook families will get a little something. But, you know, the diluted picture that he gives the audience is really necessary because if they recognize that every dollar that they're sending to him is likely going to go to legal costs or the settlement, they're going to stop sending him all that money. And he's going to not be able to do his shit anymore and not be able to scam more money from people. So it's an essential lie that he has to tell in order for that to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, you know, I'm curious about it because I don't know. I mean, I get the sense, my gut is telling me that he knows he's completely full of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's no way to really know. And, you know, he slips in and out of that character seamlessly in a sense. You know what I mean? So we don't know really where he is, but, you know, you can't argue with the courts. And, you know, at some point, they're going to come and take his stuff. And he's got to know that.
Yeah, yeah. I think there is an awareness of that. And that's why you see him at this point trying to create a lot of little lily pads, kind of. Like, he's gotten a show on Steven Crowder's Mug Club. And he's, you know, he has his new book that he's brought out. And there are various things that he's tried to do. Like, a couple months back...
He's bad at money laundering.
Yeah.
He's so... obviously like, bad at it.
Like 6 months ago or so, he launched something called Alex Jones Live that was supposed to be a business that was entirely separate from
Completely
InfoWars.
Completely separate from InfoWars. You know it because he said it.
He said it like three times in the first 20 minutes of his first show. And it was so obviously a way to try and just create a different business that wasn't under the bankruptcy. And it the bankruptcy court shut him down almost immediately.
No, I'm screaming all the time, like, buy a car, a cash-only business. What are you doing? If you're a money launderer, awesome. Do it like a drug dealer. They're really good at it.
So he, yeah, he has, I think he is aware that there is like an expiration date.
Is he up for anything criminal?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. It's all civil, right? So like hitting him where it hurts is only money out of his pocket.
Sure.
But like the,
but the, there are implications, that could come to bite him in the ass. Things like hiding money and bankruptcy fraud, those are not civil issues at that point.
Right.
So if there are, if there is a case to be made there, he should be pretty worried about that. But even beyond that, there are, you know, whispers of all sorts of other potential criminal things that he could be liable for. But a lot of that, I don't know if I see persuasive evidence.
I would say this. All right. Alex is a fantastic indictment of our stupid legal system because he's lost all of his money and he has not lost any of it. And he's allowed to spend it basically the way he wants.
He's been taking a lot of vacations to Hawaii.
Yeah. He's not received any consequences despite the fact that we all believe he has. Then second, I guarantee you that he's committed so many crimes, like so many real crimes.
It's almost unfathomable.
How many crimes? He's committed so many crimes. But because it would be so much of a chore, and also because the cops are here to beat up poor people, that will never happen. Well, I mean, maybe it'll happen.
And maybe there isn't the evidence available to
have
probable cause.
Maybe there's not the evidence available to, you know he's committed so many goddamn crimes.
Are you suggesting they do a sixth season of The Wire?
I'm not suggesting they do a sixth season of The Wire. I'm suggesting they reboot The Wire.
That.
Port of Call New Orleans.
Port of Call Austin.
I would so watch that.
Yeah, I was reading an article and they were saying like, you know, he spent $40,000 in July and he spent, you know, like they're tracking how much money he's spending. Mm-hmm. And there's no, but there's no follow through. You know, it's just like, okay, we know how much he's spending and we're watching him go out to these incredibly expensive restaurants and do what he's doing. But you guys are right. It's like, okay, so when do you actually pull that trigger? When do you actually start to dismantle this guy? Like, what are they waiting for?
Yeah, this is a tension that Jordan and I have because he has the like, take it all kind of thing. And I have a cautious belief that you just got to let the bankruptcy court exhaust all of his options. And it sucks. But, you know, everybody deserves their day in court. And that doesn't mean that someone who's abusing that, you know, we know he's abusing it.
Yeah.
But someone else could do each of the things that he's doing and be a sincere actor.
Well, see, that's the thing. That's the argument that Dan and I have, is that I would like a law that says, if you do all of the things Alex did, we take all of your money instantly. No questions asked, and problems. And Dan is like, you can't write a law that applies to only one person. And I say, yes, I can. Yeah. How about that?
My position is that it's woefully idealistic to think you could write that.
I want that law. Just of like, listen, if you do one out of three of these things, if you do two out of three of these things, but if you do all three, fuck off. You know, like I'm against the three strikes as a basic concept of legal system rules.
Except.
But on the one hand, this guy's insane!
Yeah.
Screams this guy. He's insane, I scream.
It takes one to know.
Yeah, it's frustrating, though. I mean, there's no way around that.
Yeah.
Well, guys, this journey that you're on, I really do hope that it doesn't, you know, do like real psychological damage to you guys because it's intense.
It has. Don't worry. It's too late.
I was going to say, I like the idea of you being like, hey, listen, I bet it's going to be 900 where they're finally going to start getting damaged.
No, I mean,
850 episodes. Listen, you make it through that. No big deal.
It's caused a lot of damage, obviously, but sure. We've learned to cope in some ways. And I think so many of the positives that have come out of it between things that we've heard from listeners, things that we've learned about ourselves along the way and such, I think that they far outweigh whatever damage has been done by this dumb drunk in Texas.
Yeah, I would say that as far as like that goes, I think around us, one of the things that's so amazing has flowered the audience of we call them policy wonks, or they call themselves that, and they have turned all of this like miserable, horrific tragedy and bigotry and all of that into a source of positivity for them and for ourselves. And it has been one of the more fulfilling and rewarding things that could ever have happened to us. So
yeah, and completely devoid of any work on our part or necessarily influence on our part. They a lot of people who are among them are folks who have lost family members to conspiracy shit, and you know they're able to really make a positive out of helping each other and you know being supportive, and that is. You know, that's worth whatever number of hours of listening to Alex scream.
Yeah, to facilitate that is our, like, achievement, I you know.
Well, that and, I don't know, I was going to make a joke about, we already talked about Norm making fun, or talking about
it. That's true, the 30,000,
I can't deflect this with a joke.
Oh, you son of a bitch!
So it's kind of, like, turned into your duty is what you're saying.
As a Chicago comedian, I have to say, you said duty.
No,
I thought it too.
Me too.
I don't think of it as duty as much as it is like here's a really positive thing that has come out the side of it, and there's work still to be done. You know, like there's we've learned a lot about Alex and shown a lot of things about the way his propaganda works, but that is not a completed task. And so for me, if there's any duty, it is to complete this. This work that we've embarked on.
I would also say for me, because I don't do work, I'm the guy who doesn't work. One of the great things about this is like part of the reason that I joined the show, that we started doing
joined the show.
It's his. part of the reason that we started doing this was we. You know, we said famously we hit it off, but it was like it's so much fun. To hang out with my best friend, and this was an excuse to make that happen regularly, and that's part of like being a Chicago performer.
And you know that was really what fueled it for the first few years, and now that is gone.
No, I mean that is gone. I was gonna say that it was still there, and it is for me.
Well, I have bad news.
You win some, you lose some.
Well, guys, it's been great talking to you.
Likewise. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thanks for coming on the show. And, you know, good luck keeping both your eyes on Alex Jones. It's tough job, but someone's got to do it, right?
That's what they say.
I suppose.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items where facts, two real and one fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And you know what? You can play along at home if you like. I understand that people like to do that. We have three regular news items this week. No theme. You ready?
Yes, let's do it.
Yes. All right. Here we go. Item number one, astronomers have spotted the first exoplanet collision, which happened in a system 1,800 light years away. Item number two, scientists have developed a new method of error correction in quantum computers that is 10 times as effective as previous methods, reaching fidelities of 0.999. And item number three, the NIH has announced a $150 million grant to develop a digital twin brain. An open source platform to virtually duplicate human brain function. Jay, go first.
The first one, astronomers have spotted the first exoplanet collision, which happened in a system 1,800 light years away. Well, I'll be damned. I mean, I think that I would have found that news item because of how much I read about things like this, but it is possible I missed it. And how would we be able to see this collision happen? I would imagine there would have to be transiting a sun, but that's crazy. That's a crazy situation. I don't know. I don't know if that's possible. Second one, scientists have developed a new method of error correction in quantum computers that is 10 times as effective as previous methods, reaching fidelities of 0.999. You know, I expect them to make advancements like this. I don't think this one is shocking at all. So I think that is science. And then the next one, the NIH has announced a $150 million grant to develop a digital twin brain, an open source platform to virtually duplicate the human brain function. So, yeah, this one is competing for the fiction for the first one because, you know, I don't think, first of all, I don't think we know enough about the brain to try to duplicate the human brain. I mean, who knows to what degree they would be trying to duplicate it. You know, when you say duplicate, you know, you could take that as it's going to function just like a human brain, or it's going to, you know,
that's the other idea. Way to,
what?
That's the idea.
It's going to function just like a human brain.
Yeah.
So how can it possibly be true? And $150 million, I don't think is enough to do it. That's not a lot of money when it comes to doing projects like this. So there's two things in this news item that make me question, develop a digital twin brain. I just don't think, you know, no, I got to pick that one as a fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you were reading the one about the exoplanet collision 1,800 light years away, and then this new method of error connection in quantum computers that's 10 times as effective with these 0.999 fidelity. I was like, oh no, that was a dart throw. Like, I have no idea. I don't know what the standards would be for error connection in quantum computing. I don't understand quantum computing, but I got to go with Jay on this because if it a digital twin brain, I guess by definition, because we've seen like organ twins before, I think by definition has to be it's about function, not structure. And we've only like just recently done like the connectome. You know what I mean? Like I don't understand how we could possibly. It's way too complex for that. And I agree with Jay. That's not enough money either. So structure, yes. Function, no. That's got to be the fiction.
Okay. And Bob?
I could see them doing that, creating this this twin brain in terms of like, you know, using what we already know about the brain and how, you know, the interacting networks and everything. But, you know, we know a lot. We don't know everything. We're not even close to everything. We don't know a lot of the key stuff. We don't know really what consciousness even is. But you can create, you know, attempt to create a system that works similar to the brain as far as we understand it. I mean, I could see that happening. I don't think it would, you know, probably, I don't think they would be very successful for quite some time and after a lot more than 150 million. But I could see that. This 1,800 light years exoplanet, that's far away, I think, for an exoplanet. That's pretty damn far. Sure, we've discovered some farther away, but usually it's pretty rare methods to see exoplanets that are really far away. But that 1,800 seems like far away for something like the transit method. The quantum computers, yeah, 10 times as effective as previous. Error correction, an order of magnitude better. That's huge. I'm not sure the exact significance of fidelities of 0.999. I'm not sure exactly what that means in terms of like error correction. But, you know, 10, an order of magnitude is huge because with quantum computers, error correction is so important. You don't even need a lot of qubits. You know, people talk about 1,000 qubits, 1,000,000 qubits. You don't even need that many qubits. If you've got spot on error correction, you don't even really need that many qubits because your error correction is really, really, really good. Or if you had perfect error correction, you could probably get by with, I think, like 200 qubits or something crazy low amount. So that's big. I really want that to be true because that's the kind of advances we really want to see with quantum computers at this point in time. I'm going to do, screw it. I'm going to say the 1,800 light year exoplanet collision is fiction. Plus the fact that actually seeing a collision while you're observing, that's probably almost as unlikely as winning this 1.7 billion Powerball lottery that I have tickets for. Fingers crossed.
All right, so you all agree on number two, so we'll start there. Scientists have developed a new method of error correction in quantum computers that is 10 times as effective as previous methods, reaching fidelities of 0.999. You guys all think that one is science, and that one
Please.
Is science.
That yes. is science. Yay.
Yeah.
Wow.
It sounds like a pretty solid advance,
yeah.
And Bob, you're correct that the error correction really is the big thing now. It's like the big technological hurdle for quantum computers is reducing the errors. And there's two approaches that you could take. You could prevent them from occurring in the first place, or you could fix them after they occur. And that is the method they're going with here. So it's they use this method of using laser light to illuminate the atoms which are falling out of superposition, right? So they light up, and then they could either eliminate them and replace them with other atoms, or they even said they could use the lasers to bring them back into superposition.
Really?
Yeah, or entanglement, rather.
Yeah.
Entanglement. So I don't know how that works, but the problem with the quantum computer is that you know it's based upon having entangled particles, and if particles tend to fall out of entanglement over time, and that produces the errors, or it's one way that errors are produced. So this is a way of essentially bypassing the ones that fall out of entanglement, or fixing them, or replacing them, or whatever.
Cool.
Yeah. All right, let's go on to number three. The NIH has announced a $150 million grant to develop a digital twin brain, an open source platform to virtually duplicate human brain function. Bob, you think this one is science. Jay and Carrie, you think this one is the fiction. I sense a couple of assumptions in your answers. Like, I never said that it would function in real time. That's a matter of computing power,
Be shocked if they even were thinking about that.
To me, that's not I wasn't thinking of it functioning even in real time. I still don't think we could do it.
Yeah. And again, it doesn't imply that we could do it now. It's more of...
Right. They're funding it for the future.
Yeah. They're going to develop a digital twin brain. Now we can go right to it.
Fiction, isn't it?
But they don't have a plan, do they?
They have a plan. They don't have funding. This one is the fiction.
So they do want to do it.
So there was a paper basically laying out a pathway for this to happen. But it's theoretical. It's like this. If we wanted to do it, this is what we could do. So the idea is, which is a good one. I think I spoke about this in general terms previously on the show, where if you have essentially you bring together neuroscientists and artificial intelligence, experts, programmers, etc., and they essentially try to model the brain as best as they can with the data that we currently have, which is on multiple levels, Kara. So it's the connectome is one level, but it's also just knowing how neurons function sort of at the bottom-up layer as well. And then we use that to model the brain and learn better how the brain actually functions, which then feeds back into the model itself. And then they just want to use it as sort of a feedback loop until we more and more and more accurately model the brain and develop a fully accurate digital twin of the brain. But here's a proposal for how that could happen. There's no funding or anything.
Just image a damn brain.
Means that astronomers have spotted the first exoplanet collision, which happened in a system 1,800 light years away, is science. Yeah, Bob, I think I'm just getting really good at fooling you specifically.
Of course you are.
No, because I saw the 1,800 light years is what sold it for me. Because like,
me and Jay are like, doo-doo-doo. Maybe that's far. I don't know.
Yeah, like, I knew like if it were a lot closer, it would seem more plausible. So they think that they are seeing evidence of two ice giant exoplanets colliding around a sun-like star and sending up a massive plume, which then blocked out the star, right? So you have a light dip, but also it then irradiates in the infrared. There's an afterglow. So it's the combination of those things, of those two things. It's a characteristic drop in the light curve from a giant cloud, passing in front of the star, but also that cloud gets heated up and irradiates itself in the infrared. So that is this was spotted, and the data was sort of made available for a lot of people to look at. They shared the light curves, and it was actually an astronomer on social media was the first one to point out that there was this infrared brightening, 1,000 days before the optical fading, and that was unusual. Like, we'd never really seen that before. And then that's what led to something more interesting and rare is happening here. This isn't just a dust cloud. And then they eventually concluded, yep, it's probably two ice giants crashing into each other. Yeah, very, very cool. It is very lucky, cool. You know, to see that happening. But yeah. All right. Well, good job, Jay and Kara.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Whatever.
Thanks, Jay.
So
you got it.
Evan is not here. So I came up with a quote for this week. The quote is, sciences provide an understanding of a universal experience. Arts are a universal understanding of personal experience. The arts and sciences are avatars of human creativity. Who do you think said that? That was from Mae Jemison, the first African-American woman astronaut in space.
Yeah.
Oh, that, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it, you know, bringing the arts and the sciences together, seeing how they sort of have a complementary view of human creativity and experience. All right, you guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
Sure, man. Time to watch some Halloween shows.
Right, Bob?
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.